interchangeable.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to everyone, wherever you may be. I'm here with Kirk and James this evening. Hi, fellas.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good. We are in the midst of reviewing what I think is as important a discussion as you'll find anywhere in the Torah. And it's a culmination, really, of Yahweh's discussion with Abraham, where after he has explained all the terms and conditions of the covenant to Abraham, spent a lot of time on the fifth condition, which is circumcision, shared with Abraham all the benefits of the covenant, and then helped Abraham and his wife, Sarah, conceive a child, Laughter. Yahweh said, I want to examine whether or not you understand what I have asked of you, what I'm offering you, and I would really like you to respond in an appropriate way, but out of knowledge and understanding as opposed to any other way. And this begins a really interesting presentation. And there are two ways you can look at it. One is you can say, all right, God really is sincere when he says that it is important for us to observe, which is closely examine and carefully consider what he has written on our behalf, to listen to him, which is to recite his words, such that we understand them and make the necessary connections so that we can respond appropriately. Otherwise, why would there be this test? I mean, obviously, Yahweh picked Abraham out. He met him on the way out of Babylon, and then he, over a course of many years, intervened in his life and shared this amazing story and opportunity with him. So at this point, Yahweh's already stated to Abraham that he considered Abraham's response. Remember, he took Abraham to the stars and then to the spiritual realm and showed him what he was really inheriting, and then based upon Abraham's response, God credited all of that to him in such a way he viewed him as right and vindicated.
Mm-hmm.
So Abraham's already in the covenant. This test is not for him. The test is for us.
For us.
Yeah. And it's for us the same way, by the way, in the sense what it does is it affirms that Yahweh has established the covenant and conveyed it in such a way that he expects us to take the time to appreciate what he's offering, to think about the best and most appropriate way to respond, and then act upon his words. And that he is affirming that when we do that, that he will come through and provide what we need. There'll be no sacrifice on our part. He'll make the sacrifice. So he's doing the same. He's engaged in this discussion with Abraham and this whole journey for the same reason he's involved, he's conveyed it to us, which is that it's important for us to know that participation in the covenant is not based on faith. It's not based upon anything other than listening to what God says, coming to understand it, and responding appropriately. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a second reason for this presentation. What do you think that is? I think the second reason for this test is far more important than the first reason. You guys have any idea what that might be?
You keep out the undesirable?
Nope, I don't think so. Well, no, that means, of course, that God has the conditions of the covenant to keep, to have as a filter, to keep mm-hmm. out those who would make heaven miserable, those who make the earth miserable. So I think that the primary reason for this is that God is using it to connect the terms and conditions and benefits of the covenant with the Moed Mikre, with the invitations to enter his home and be part of his family and to live with him. And so this entire episode, this walk to Mount Moriah, these two witnesses that would be down at the bottom through whom Abraham would share this restoring testimony, the sacrifice that would be made on Mount Moriah, but not by Abraham or Yitzhak, but with God himself providing. Mm-hmm. And all the way through, God saying, you know, here I am. And with the sacrificial lamb caught in the thickets at the top of Mount Moriah, and all of this occurring exactly 40 Yovel or 2,000 years before Yosha, as the perfect Passover lamb, would do this very same thing in this very same place. So I think that the story is being told even more for the integration of Passover, Matzah, and Bikurim than it is for the purpose of affirming that there are conditions which must be understood and acted upon to participate in the covenant. I don't know which one of those two are more.
Makes sense to me.
I think when we listen to the story, we really ought to pay attention that this is not taking place in any old place. This is not taking place at any old time. This is exactly 40 Yobel from the fulfillment on Passover in year 4000, 33 CE. And this is no ordinary place. This is the place that Yosha would fulfill Pesach on Mount Moriah. So, as we press on to the story, we're at Bereshith 22:6 in the beginning, Genesis. And it reads, "And Abraham obtained and grasped hold of the wooden timbers associated with the elevating offering. And he placed it upon Yitzhak, his son. And he grasped hold of and accepted in his hand, therefore, the fire and that which is associated with the knife. So the two of them were in one accord." All right, so what's the symbolism here? First, we always have to keep in mind that God gave Abraham this name for a reason. That was not his name. God gave him this name, and it's a name that means father who raises and lifts up, those who stand up and reach up. So Abraham represents in this story Yahweh. Yitzhak represents Yahusha. This is a dress rehearsal for Passover on Mount Moriah in year 4000. Yeah. So he obtained and grasped hold of the wooden timbers associated with the elevating offering. Well, wasn't Yosha, wouldn't Yosha be asked to carry the upright pillar and the beam, the cross beam that would be, in fact, that particularly the upright, the cross beam, just as Yishak was doing here. You know, it wasn't Abraham's the big man. He's not carrying the wood. Yishak is. Yishak represents Yosha. It was Yosha that carried the wood. Mm-hmm. He had the doorway to life on his back. And what the words here are conveying, this etze, it's, these are the upright pillars of the doorway to Yahweh's home. And then we have Ha'ola, that which rises, that which ascends, that which goes up, that which withdraws and carries away. Ha'ola. And he placed it upon Yishak, his son. So Yishak represents Yosha, just as Yosha carried the upright the pillars and had that on his back as he fulfilled Pesach. And then he grasped hold of and accepted in his hand, therefore, the knife, that which exists as radiant energy to provide light and warmth. It's Ha'ish. And by the way, grasped hold of and accepted in his hand the fire, Ish, that which is radiant energy that provides light. And the reason he's carrying the fire, and I'm sure it's by way of a firebrand or a torch here, is that he again represents Yahweh, who is light. Pesach and Matzah are means of purification. Fire is always shown as a means of purification. So that's why he's carrying the fire. He represents the very light of God. Just as Yahweh appeared as light on the top of Mount Horeb during the Exodus. And that which is associated with the knife, the implement used for cutting and separating from a call, which means to devour. Every aspect of this doorway is an act of separation. Those who go into it are separated from those who are not allowed in. Those who are not allowed in are separated from those who are part of Yahweh's family. It is speaking here of separation. But the knife is also symbolic to the story of what would occur 2,000 years later and 40 years later when Yosha's side was pierced to make certain that the body was dead. And so that's why the knife. So the two of them walked together in one accord. That's the most important line of all. Why do you think that line is even put in there? I mean, you've got Yishak with the wood and his father Abraham with the fire and the separating the knife, the cutting implement.
Well, they why actually look to be on the same page.
Yeah.
And then volitionally as well. So.
Remember a couple of shows ago, we were responding to a member of the covenant family who was asked by Christians, well, you know, if the Torah is true, then why did Yosha have to, they have Jesus, but Jesus have to shed his blood. Okay, he's the Passover lamb.
Yeah.
It is that his blood being smeared on the doorway to life is the very essence of what he's doing. Apart from Passover, it's just a gruesome scene. Well, in this particular case, Yosha and Yahweh have to be of one accord. In other words, Yosha's actions as he fulfills Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim have to be in one accord with Yahweh and his revelation in the Torah, or they don't do any good. And so it's being presented here that Yishak and his father, Abraham, who represent Yahweh and Yosha, are in one accord. There aren't two accords here. There's not... the Father's plan and the Son's plan. You know, that's the Christian idea. They know there's the mean God of the Old Testament, but the Son had a better plan. They were in a different place as opposed to one accord. Now, Yosha's view was, I'm in one accord. I didn't come to contradict the Torah. I came to fulfill it. I'm not going to do away with any part of it.
You know, right above your shod, you have Shanayim, or Shanayim, which is two, but in the concept of repeating something that repeats itself. So far, everything you've said, and everything I've looked up, and I'm sure James as well, Yahweh hasn't missed a trick on telling this story down to the minute
right.
detail.
Right.
I mean, and the two being repeating because this story is a precursor, and it's going to be repeated in reality, where this one is symbolic. I mean, it's, that's an amazing sentence.
Yeah, I would ask you how many of the seven Moed Mikre
mm-hmm.
have wood as a predominant element of the story?
Is this one, I think.
Passover, right?
I mean, you cook meals.
Passover is because
yeah.
where is the blood of the sacrificial lamb?
The upright pillar.
The upright pillars and the lintel of the doorway to life, right?
Mm-hmm.
The family home. Mm-hmm. The only one that has wood. This one has wood. Where, other than Passover, is there any other of the seven Mikre where there are specific instructions of how to prepare that animal so that you take its life in just the proper way and thus the knife?
Mm-hmm. No.
Passover
no.
set?
No, that's it.
Right?
Oh, correct.
Yeah. And with Passover, you are going through the doorway to life right into God's home, and fire light is the essence of eternal life. It's the essence of coming into Yahweh's presence, whether it's on Mount Moriah or on Mount Horeb, as the Torah is being revealed. But all of that being the case, Kirk, the single most important line is the two of them walked together in one accord.
Together. Absolutely.
What that, if you're a thinking, rational individual, and you know what this story represents, what you have here is Father and Son acting in harmony. They're both committed to doing the right thing for the right reasons. And it precludes the notion of a Christian New Testament. It precludes the idea that there was a Jesus that operated independent of God.
Mm-hmm. Or he was replacing God.
Right. It has them operating in one accord. Yahweh and Yosha. And when you understand that, you understand there is no possibility for Judaism, Islam, or Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That all three religions, by that little line, have to be discarded because they all claim their authenticity based upon the revelations in the Torah. And the Torah has just contradicted them. Now, Paul and God were not of one accord. They were of opposite viewpoints,
mm-hmm.
by Paul say. Yes. Yosha and Yahweh were of one accord. So that's Bereshith 22:6. And, you know, just every aspect of that is so beautiful because Halak, Shinayim, is both of them journeyed together in unity with each other, reciprocating with one another, united and alike in love. From Yichad, the only begotten and beloved son. Wahalak, Shimein, Him, Yada. Marvelous. Yeah, as you say, Kirk.
Yeah.
Every letter of every word contributes to this story. And Ishak spoke to Abraham, his father, stating, "Father of mine." So he responded and said, "Here I am, my son." Now, before we go any further, I am certain that 99.9999% of people that read this would just read right through that and have no clue as to why that's there. It's just, you know, for them it would be stiff. You know, it would be dialogue that would never make the script for the movie. Why is that there? Why did God inspire Moshe to write the words, and why did he convey in this conversation, "And Yitzhak spoke to Abraham, his father, stating, 'Father of mine,' so he responded, 'Here I am, my son.'" What's the lesson in those words? The lesson is that Yitzhak was talking to his father. Yitzhak represents Yosha.
Yosha
is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. He is not the totality of Yahweh. That is why Yosha spoke to Yahweh. And if you understand that, then it destroys the myth that Jesus Christ is God. No, Yahweh is God. Yosha is the diminished manifestation of God. Yitzhak is speaking to his father, just as Yosha would speak to Yahweh. You know, if Jesus was the totality of God, he'd be mumbling to himself over there. I mean, in fact, if he was talking to himself, they would want to lock him up as a crazy dude. What are you doing talking to yourself like that? No, he was talking to the Father, because the Father is God. So this begins, "And laughter spoke to Abraham," representing Yahweh, the Father who raises and lifts up, who reaches up. His Father, just as the Son would talk to his Father 2,000 years later in this very same place. The establishing this as a Father and Son, the first Father and Son of the covenant, is so essential because this is the role that Yahweh and Yosha would play 40 Obel later, stating, "Father of mine." This is what we all want to be, Yitzhak, with Yahweh. So he responded, "Here I am, my son. Here I am. Hena Ani. Here I am. Look up at me. Pay attention to the details of this discussion. Right now, here I am, my son." You know, when Abraham was struggling early on in the relationship, and you know, he might fell down a couple of times, but the first thing that Yahweh said, "Hena Ani, look up.
Here I am.
Here I am. Here I am." So
again, look up. Don't bow down.
Right. Don't bow down. Look up. And again, this positions our thought process, so we should be viewing Yitzhak and Abraham, his father, as acting out the same roles that Yosha and Yahweh would play out 40 Yobel later in this exact same place. Then he asks, "Behold."
And again?
"Look. Right now. Paying attention to these details. The fire. And the wooden pillars. But where is the lamb for the elevated offering for us to be carried away?" Now, first time I translate this, okay, you know, all right. So, you know, it's the lamb. The lamb is obviously the Passover lamb, and he's saying, you know, where's the lamb? And okay, so it's just tying into to Passover. But, and of course, the implications are straightforward, and for the Christian that would say, then why did Yosha have to send his blood? He was the Passover lamb. That's why you have to have the lamb. Without the lamb, you got nothing. And by the way, it's also interesting, too, that after Yosha was pierced in the way that he was nailed to the wooden timbers, his physical body was consumed in fire at the Passover lamb. That's why the body that they, the manifestation of Yosha on Makudam, that his mother and the women in his life had seen, and that the disciples saw in the upper room and the fellows on the road to Emmaus saw, was not the same body.
No.
It's because his body was consumed in fire. And so, you know, we got the fire. We got the wooden pillars for the upright pole of Pesach and the doorway to life. And we got that that fire for all it represents. But where's the lamp?
My question is, why would a Christian ask that to begin with when Yosha states, I think multiple times, he says that, you know, this is the purpose I came. Remember when Peter or Yochanan?
Right.
Shimon Kevish says to him, don't go, or we don't want you to go, I want you to stay. And he said, well, get behind me, Satan.
Yeah, get behind me, Satan. Right.
He said, this is the reason I'm here. So why should that freak out a Christian? On that? To me, it's not even, it's an odd question. Even as a Christian, I don't think I would have asked that.
Yeah, he came to fulfill Passover, Matzah and Bukodim.
Now the question I would ask is, how did Yitzchak know to expect a lamb?
That is correct.
Well, he
never knew they were going to make a sacrifice a lamb. He just told them we're going up there.
And so had to be
if he didn't have the Torah.
Right. There's only two possible answers, and since there are two possible answers, I did a lot of research, and I'm going to read the research because I think it's important here. There's only two possible answers, and that is that it was customary to sacrifice lambs. So everybody, if they were going to make a sacrifice, everybody was sacrificing a lamb. So we just assumed there had to be a lamb, right? The Canaanites must be sacrificing a lamb. The Egyptians must be sacrificing a lamb. The Babylonians, where Dad came from, must be sacrificing lambs. The Assyrians, where they walked through, must have been sacrificing lambs. Everybody must have been sacrificing lambs. So he just naturally said, where's the lamb? That's one possibility.
That'd be valid.
That'd be a valid possibility until you did
the research.
And I'm going to share that with you because I did.
Okay.
And the other possibility is, yeah, I told them about Passover. He explained why they were here. And just as Yahweh said that he shared his Torah teaching with Abraham, this is now affirming it, and that Abraham did what he was supposed to do, and he shared Yahweh's Torah teaching with his son. That's why they knew that this was Passover, and that's why he knew there needed to be a lamb. But the moment that lamb is there, if you don't ask those two questions and then say, which one of those two is true? Because it's one or the other. There is, I'll give you, you know, the rest of the program to come up with a third option here. Because there's only two.
Good luck.
And one of them is confirmed by Yahweh, and the other one is negated by history. So, first thing, there are a surprising number of Hebrew words for lamb, each providing a nuance which is appropriate to the context and designed to enhance our understanding. In this case, at least based upon the most closely related words to ha, se, draws our attention to the brilliant witness comprised of light, providing direct knowledge about this specific situation while teaching us about the subsequent event destined to occur in the same place, who serves as an advocate and spokesperson on behalf of the accused. I mean, when I see lamb, the first thing I do is say, oh, you know, there's five or six words for lamb, and we are accustomed to seeing them, those of us who translate a lot.
Hmm?
But how many times have you come across seh as the Hebrew word for lamb? That was a new one to me. And so I said, okay, why did he use it as opposed to, you know, like Gabesh, for example? This one as opposed to all of the other words that he has for lamb that he uses so frequently? Well, this word means far more than lamb. This is a brilliant witness comprised of light.
Yes.
That's what Yosha was, the brilliant witness comprised of light, providing direct knowledge about this specific situation, about Pesach, while teaching us about the subsequent events destined to occur in this place, the fulfillment of Pesach, who serves as an advocate and spokesman on behalf of the accused. That would be him for us. Mm-hmm. What a marvelous word.
Yeah. I got some more if you want.
Please.
Okay, well, you start with the Seth, which is the lamb, the flock, the sheep, the goat, and that comes from Zeth, which is the lamb, 77:17. Somebody's looking in 77:16 is what I'm talking about. And then it says a witness, an advocate, a testimony, a record that lays the foundation for truth about an event. And then if you look at the letters, you have the Shemek and the Hay, man looking up, and the thorn. And then the last word, of course, is the delete, which is the entranceway door to the breath of covenant. So,
yes.
Gosh, that's an awful lot of stuff about this story that's so accurate. I kind of went to bed the other night kind of freaking out going, you know, this just, I can't argue with this at all. I don't even, you know, I'm a bad person on the show because I ain't got much to say other than, yeah, that's right. it is so straightforward to me and so accurate. There's another one, and meaning too, is the root is a sheep and a veil, which I thought very odd, veil for a ram. But it says from behind, but then I started thinking about from behind the veil was brought forth Yosha telling the story.
Yeah, also Kirk, what happened to the veil that separated the most set apart? Where the Ark of the Covenant would typically be kept in Yahweh's house. Now, it wasn't there at that moment because it was sitting right below him in Jeremiah's grotto, so that the blood of the Pesach lamb could drip upon the mercy seat. But the separation was that veil was rent, wasn't it? It was torn.
Now, how do a bunch of folks get together and put this together if it's a lie?
They
must be the most brilliant people in the history of the world. I mean,
and you know what? One of the things that's just so sad is that while Seth can be translated lamb,
yes,
and lamb is an appropriate translation in this context,
mm-hmm.
the word is so rich and it means so much more that all the identity of the lamb is explained if you just take time to investigate the full meaning of the word. This is a place where an amplified translation is infinitely more enlightening and empowering than is a simpleton's translation. And it's one of the things I've always questioned about English translations. You know, if Hebrew has 10 words for something, like it does for lamb, isn't it incumbent for us to at least take a moment to distinguish between them so that we can attempt to convey why one was chosen in a particular context versus another?
You think so?
No, when Yahweh speaks of sheep being part of his flock and of him being the shepherd, and he has even doed in that role as a shepherd over sheep, he does not use sheep. Because I want to tell you, you know, on our best day, we don't fit the full and rich meaning of a brilliant witness comprised of light providing direct knowledge about the specific situation while teaching about the subsequent events destined to occur in this same place. It says, Yosha.
Well, that's another thing that I try to keep in mind when I'm doing this stuff as well, is because I try to keep always remember that Yahweh is a teacher, and he's teaching this story far more to us than to Abraham. He was living it. And in the telling of it, he just doesn't leave any stone unturned, and he repeats and repeats. There's a lot of repetitive looking up in this little section all the way through 22:12. But it's because Yahweh keeps saying over and over and over again, so you can't miss the point if you're looking. So,
I'm just going to read this next paragraph. I've already stated it. I shared it with it, but it bears being reinforced. Yishak's question regarding the lamb, while seemingly subtle and innocuous, affirms two profoundly important aspects of their adventure to Mount Moriah. For him to have recognized they needed the lamb to roast on the fire requires an understanding of the Torah, of Yahweh's teaching. Abraham had obviously shared it with him, even at an early age. and even more revealing. They were intending to celebrate Passover, just as Yosha did 40 Yobel later on the same mountain. Now, as proof of that, Abraham and Yitzhak were operating out of an entirely different playbook, one comprised by God and in universal conflict with the rest of humanity circa 1968 BCE. In the cradle of civilization, indeed, Abraham's birthplace, the Sumerians were sacrificing humans, not lambs. 6 years ago, archaeologists at the University of Pennsylvania reached this conclusion after conducting CT scans on the skulls of over 2,000 victims buried in 16 golden tombs in a single royal cemetery in Sumer. These researchers reported that human sacrifice was conducted on a very large scale. I just read this much. And I remember doing this research when I wrote this, and it causes my stomach to turn. When I read this, it takes me back to one of the places that I have been where people were sacrificed in mass. In fact, there's two of them. One is on the Big Island of Hawaii when the folks from Tahiti sailed up to establish the authority of the king. The king and the chief medicine man, the cleric, the priest, got in unison so that if anyone were to rebel against the king or the religion, the king and his military and the religious authorities would work in harmony to kill that person. And if anybody, and just to demonstrate that it was futile to protest and not be an exuberant enthusiast for the unity of priest and king, they would routinely sacrifice live humans, routinely. And I remember the place in Hawaii where this was done, and tens of thousands of people were sacrificed in front of throngs of religious and political people by the priests. And, you know, I remember going to Nazi Germany where the sacrifice of millions of Jewish women and children was done to satiate the religious and political zeal of Nazis. And so I read this kind of stuff and I realize just how despicable religion has been throughout the ages and this unification of religion and politics. And you realize that, you know, that is the very essence of Islam. It's always been a where the religion and politics are inseparable, and it is a death cult. But look at Christianity. Christianity is Imperial Rome. Imperial Rome became the Roman Catholic Church. It became the essence of Christianity. It was born out of politics. And that's why Paul's preeminent letter was written to the Romans, saying that the Roman government was ordained by God and that people should submit to it. So, when the political forces unite with the religious forces, humans are sacrificed on a massive scale. And that is what is happening here. So I want to get back to the text. It's hard for me to read this without my mind going to those places. I just want to share that. The skulls of over 2,000 victims buried in 16 golden tombs in a single royal cemetery in Sumer. These researchers reported that human sacrifices were conducted on a very large scale. The common characteristics of these ancient remains was that two 1-inch diameter spikes had been driven through the heads of the men and one through the women while they were still alive. That was the religious aspect of these people. Their bodies were then baked, but not burned, then doused with mercury so they wouldn't decompose and could be put on display during religious ceremonies. Abraham's countrymen sought to appease their gods through religious mass murder. Where's the lamb, indeed? especially wanton during this time in Sumerian and Egyptian, the time the Samaritan and the Egyptian lords, priests, and kings had countless servants, concubines, musicians, handmaidens, grooms, guards, and soldiers murdered because their clerics claimed that the dead would continue to serve their masters in their afterlife. Worse, the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians sacrificed infants to their gods. And one ceremony alone, urns containing the tiny bones of 20,000 ritualistically murdered children have been found. Now think about that. The Phoenicians and the Carthaginians. 20,000, just on one event, one religious ceremony, 20,000 infants were ritualistically murdered in the name of religion. You know, to say that religion is a force for good requires complete naivete. It has recently been discovered that the Greeks practiced human sacrifice, as did the Romans, through the 2nd century BCE. The Mongols, the Druids, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Incans, the Phoenicians and Africans prolifically, barbarically, and religiously sacrificed innocent human lives on behalf of make-believe gods. So the only reason that Yishak would have asked his father about the lamb is because he was aware of Yahweh's instructions regarding Passover. And by the way, last time I checked, humans required protein to live. That we are omnivores, but we are omnivores that require protein, like a carnivore does. And it's our brains function on protein. Our muscles function on protein. The lamb's food.
Yeah.
It's not, the lamb isn't offered to God. God has no use for the lamb.
The silliness of this, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah. You know, for people think that the lamb is ritualistically sacrificed, that's cruel, PETA. I'm telling you, the lamb's food.
Yeah.
You know, the lamb wasn't sacrificed any more than a pack of wolves eats the lamb and says, "Well, boy, I bet our wolf god is happy we did that today." You see how hungry the wolf god is, and we didn't hardly have any to eat. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
The lamb is dinner, and in this particular case, when humans are sacrificed, they're not eaten. It's just an absolute waste of life. There is sound justification in this particular passage for translating Olah as elevating offering rather than burnt offering. And yet the latter is somehow rendered in virtually every English Bible. So I thought it was important to explain why I chose the different approach. And we've been over this before. Virtually every Hebrew noun is defined by its actionable root. And Olah is based on the verb Allah. In fact, Kirk, what is the difference between the three letters that comprise Olah and the three Hebrew letters that comprise Allah, the verb?
Well, there's an ain and then a waw and a lamb and a
an hay. An ain and a lamed and a hay, right?
Uh-huh. And the Allah is a ain, a lamb, and a hay. So what I'm missing is the waw.
Well, no, there's no law in either of them. You're thinking about the word for infinity.
Yes,
olam. Yeah, no, it's lamed and hey. They're written identically is the answer. There is no difference.
Yes.
They're written identically. So Allah and Allah are the same words. It's not, by the way, the Allah is in the Islamic God.
No.
That's with an LF. Not with the ain. And it means the verb. Does not mean to burn. The verb does not mean to offer. The verb means to ascend, to go up, to be withdrawn, to be carried away. And so since the verb defines the noun, in every Hebrew, okay, in every case in Hebrew, Olah, if you want to be precisely accurate, it means to uplift, to ascend, to go up, to be carried. to be carried away.
I don't know where I looked at that version.
Yeah. Graphically, the letters are an I, which is perspective, right? Lamed, right. Which is the shepherd's staff.
Staff. Yeah.
And a person standing
on
the
floor. It can be support,
it's
an upright pole, it can lead you, protect you.
Right. So it encourages us to observe the perspective and purpose of the shepherd, the Lamed, when we want to stand with him. Therefore, Allah conveys the result of being Torah observant. We grow to appreciate what Yosha did on our behalf on Pesach and Matzah, enabling us as the covenant children to Allah to ascend as a result of being withdrawn and then carried away by God. The word is extraordinarily descriptive, pertinent, relevant, visual, expressive, educational, and enlightening. When you know what it really means. God is not asking anyone to go out there and build a fire to sacrifice an animal. This is the God's way of lifting up those who, from the right perspective, observe the role of the shepherd in protecting us and leading us, and who, as a result, reach up and look up to God and walk with him. Hola.
I thought it was interesting. It also has a meaning of lifting up a burden, you know, to put on another's shoulders, as Yahusha would do. I thought that was pretty cool, too. Yeah, I'm telling you, I know where I looked, there wasn't that. So it's not. There's no argument. There's no burnt offering.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing burnt, and there's nothing offering about the word. It means to uplift, to rise. Abraham responded. God will actually and continually reveal to understand how to approach him by way of the Lamb for the purpose of ascending and being carried away, my son. Then the two of them walked together in one accord. Oh, gosh. God is such a marvelous communicator.
Mm-hmm.
So your son said, where's the Lamb, Dad? We're going to be celebrating Passover. We got it all, but where's the Lamb? Abraham provided the answer. It's just like if you have a question of God, God provides the answer. Read the Torah. Abraham responded. He answered. He proclaimed. He declared. Elohim, God Almighty, will actually continue to reveal the proper perspective to understand how to approach him by way of the Lamb. Ra'ah. It means to lead, to shepherd, to protect. It also means to see, making visible, to provide the proper perspective to understand. And then Lahu, the way to approach him, to draw near, to be in one accord with him, all in accordance with the Lamb. And this particular Lamb, again, is Haseh, related to Sha'ed, a brilliant witness comprised of light, providing direct knowledge about the situation and teaching regarding the subsequent event, which serves as an advocate and witness on behalf of the accused. All for the purpose of ascending, being withdrawn and carried away. La Ola, my son. And then once again, now that Abraham has explained to Yishak, his son, that God's going to provide the Lamb, they walked in one accord. So, if Abraham knows that God's going to provide the Lamb, was Abraham ever even for a second of the opinion that he was going to be sacrificing his son as the Lamb?
No, he couldn't.
No. He didn't get up in the morning and hit on him there,
like they did on the donkey, with the donkey falling,
right?
He knew.
he trusted. He made it real clear that, you know, hey, he didn't say, I don't know. He said, son, you know.
No, that's true, exactly.
The Torah is really clear. Yahweh provides the lamb. The fulfillment of what we're doing here, the ultimate purpose of this whole story, is that Yahweh, God himself, is going to provide the lamb. And Yoshua did. He provided the Passover lamb. And once again, reinforcing this, the two of them walked together in one accord. It's extremely clear. When they came to the place, Makum, the standing place, the site where one takes a stand, the source of direction in life, which bestows the blessings of the relationship, which provides the benefits of an upright, fortuitous, and elevated state, a joyful and happy attitude, an encouraged and content mindset to those walking the correct way along the proper and specific path to a prosperous life. Asher, what a wonderful term.
Mm-hmm.
That the Almighty had told him about. There, Abraham built Bana, established for the family, to restore the home. An altar, a place to thank God and to show his appreciation. And he arranged the wooden planks. Then he connected these things together with Yishak, his son, positioning him accordingly before the altar, in conjunction with the upright and ascending nature associated with the wooden pillars. Now, what's interesting here is just how specific all of this is. They arrived. Bo. They entered into. And they came to the standing place. The place where God himself would take a stand on our behalf.
Yeah.
Makum. Yeah, the standing place.
Stand up for us, yeah.
Which bestows the blessings of the relationship. Which shows the path to live a prosperous life. It's the doorway begins here in the path to God. The first step is Pesach. It all begins on what happens on Passover on Mount Moriah, Asher. The Almighty had told them about. They were not acting of their own accord. They were doing what Yahweh had told them about. Abraham, the merciful father, the father who uplifts. Bana, built, established to restore the family. Bana is such a marvelous term. In fact, Yosha used Bana when he spoke to Shimon Kefish. You know, he says, you know, upon this rock I will build my mikre, my invitations to be called out and meet. Bana was the verb that he used, being used right here. And remember, Yosha spoke Hebrew. He said Bana. Bana is being used here. Bana is the first two letters of Bana are identical with son,
mm-hmm.
family, and the sperm, ba, beth, and nun, followed by the person who is observant, reaching up, standing up, and looking up to God, bana, to build the family. And he built this place to thank God, this altar, and he arranged the wooden planks. Well, what he's doing here is these wooden planks are being arranged in such a way that he can associate them with Yishak, his son. Now, I think there's this whole impression that he's laying his son down on. Well, that wouldn't be the visual imagery. No, these wooden planks are being set far more upright so that his son can lean against them, his back to them. Why? Because Yosha's back was placed upon the upright beam. He was placed up against the doorway to life. The very stance here and the very presentation of these wooden pillars and Yosha and Isaac's position relative to them is exactly synonymous with what was going to happen 40 years later. And therefore, he connected these things together with Yishak, Akid. He fastened them together. Well, Yosha was connected to the doorway to life. He was literally nailed to it. Yeah, I was not going to allow Yishak to be nailed to it, but he was these using words that say the same thing. He fastened these connected these things together. He fastened them together with Yishak. Associate them in this way with his son. Positioning him accordingly, just as Yosha was properly positioned on the doorway to life. Before, on, toward, against, in front of. You know, that people would say that all means on. Well, so you would just say, well, he was laying down on, but it doesn't say lay down on.
And
it just says toward, against, or in front of. And you can stand up against the wall, and it would be, you know similar here. That's what he's doing upon this altar, this place to thank God, in conjunction with the upright. And this is what's really interesting. This is one of the reasons why I'm so convinced that these wood planks were presented vertically, and that Yishak was associated with them, was put in position up against them vertically, just as Yosha would be on the upright pole that became the doorway to life. It's because we're told that everything here, this altar, in conjunction with the upward and ascending nature associated with the wooden pillars. Ma'al means to a higher position beyond the higher dimensions, but it speaks of upward and ascending. That's the way that the pillars were arranged according to God. And that the doorway to life takes us to a higher position, to higher dimensions, to eternity with God. So this notion that he made a bed of these things and laid his son down on them, he would not have used Ma'al in this context. So this is being presented again as a visual representation of what would occur 40 Yovel later.
Yeah, there's nothing horizontal about that, is it? Exceedingly high.
No. Yeah, is there anything horizontal about Ma'al?
No. I'm looking at everything I looked up. Ain't nothing there that's even close.
So it's amazing how people then would present it that way, because you know that's the way that pagans, roasted
with
humans on their bonfires.
To
cremate.
Like the Aztecs, they do that too.
Yeah.
But, cut the hearts out. It's just horrible.
So next, Abraham reached out his hand and grasped hold of the knife to move in the direction of offering his son. So Abraham knew precisely what was required. God had taught him all about Pesach. And he knew that in this particular role, on this day, that he was representing Almighty God, and that Yishak, his son, was representing Yosha, and that when Yosha would later say through Dode, that when he is associated with sin, I will not spare the rod, that in fact here, the word for rod is can also mean knife or cutting implement, he knows that his son is representing the role that Yah was going to play through the sacrificial lamb of Passover. So he's going to go with this dress rehearsal for Passover, this living enactment 40 Yovel before Passover would occur in this place, because he understands what is happening. Therefore, he moved in the direction of offering his son. He grasped hold of in his hand of that knife, of that cutting and separating implement. Now, the last thing, of course, that God wanted was for Abraham to end the life of the boy whose birth he had miraculously facilitated. He had already promised that his eternal covenant would be established with Yitzhak. So Abraham recognized that God was going to intervene, just as he had on previous occasions. This was a test, nothing more, nothing less. The questions being resolved here were whether or not Abraham and Yitzhak were willing to follow Yahweh's explicit instructions as they were articulated to them, and if they trusted God to do as he promised, even with their very lives. You know, but most importantly, father and son were being asked to play in a dress rehearsal, and they represented the roles of Yahweh and Yosha on Passover circa year 4000 Yah. It would be here on Mount Moriah that the Son of God, serving as the outstretched hand of Yahweh, would be pierced as the sacrificial lamb on Passover, while affixed to an upright pillar of wood. Marvelous, with every last detail. Then a spiritual messenger, a malach, a heavenly representative and divine implement of Yahweh, called out Hara.
What's the basis of the of Mikre? The invitations to meet
Hara.
Hara. So Yahweh, Hara.
Mm-hmm.
To him. You know, when God is speaking to someone, what's the normal Hebrew word that would convey God's talk to him?
Amar.
Right, Amar. Amar is used probably.
Or Dabar.
Yeah, 70% of the time. Spoke words is Dabar, correct? So Amar is used maybe 70% of the time. Dabar is used 29% of the time. You're getting the point. Kara, mm-hmm. in this particular case,
when it's used, it's for a very specific reason.
Right. So what Yahweh was doing, he was calling out to him, he was summoning him, he was inviting him, he was welcoming him. So he was announcing the Mikra, which is based on the verb kara. Wasn't used here by happenstance. Then a spiritual messenger of Yahweh called out to him from heaven. And he said, Abraham, Abraham. Now, by the way, Yahweh is not a malach. Malach are spiritual implements of Yahweh. Mm-hmm. Purposefully established to convey his message. Yahweh is a seven-dimensional construct, cannot appear in 3D. Yahweh will not fit in 3D. So Yahweh is as present in this moment as it is possible for him to be. And so this malach is as much of is being used as an implement to convey Yahweh's presence to Abraham and Yitzhak. I think in this particular case, rather than looking at this malach as a unique individual, I think this malach is the implement Yahweh is using. So it'd be like viewing the paintbrush that Walt Disney would have used to paint the canvas for a scene with Mickey Mouse. So I think this malach, this heavenly representative, this divine implement of Yahweh, is Yahweh participating in this setting in such a way that the light, the spiritual light of this implement gave Yahweh the opportunity to be seen and to be heard.
Is it Yahusha
Yosha something like Yosha, or is it the Ruach Kodesh? Can she diminish herself?
You know, he didn't use the Ruach of Yahweh.
No, he didn't. No.
And he did not use Ish. Ish is Yahweh uses Ish when he's going to take physical form, so it's a radically diminished manifestation of Yahweh. So, for example, several of the times that Abraham is talking with Yahweh, Yahweh will present himself as one,
right.
two, or three-ish individuals
yeah, right.
that's walked with him. If the term Ish is not here, the term Ruach is not here. And so, as I study this, I think about what is a Malach. A Malach is a spiritual, energy-based implement designed to convey Yahweh's presence and message. I see this Malach as being an implement that Yah is using to be present in this setting. So as a spiritual implement, Yahweh doesn't have to diminish himself. He just really has to convey his nature through this energy-based spiritual implement.
Yeah.
And he can be right there in the presence of Abraham and Yitzchak in 3D. So, a spiritual message. And by the way, that's my conclusion. If somebody has a conclusion that it's just one of, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of Malach that are implements and a command and control regimen that is speaking for you, that's fine. I think it's far more personal than that, though.
Mm-hmm.
I just think this Malach is literally, far more than if, let's say that you're a fan of let's go back to one of the old crooners, Frank Sinatra. Well,
mm-hmm.
It'd be pretty hard for Frank Sinatra to come into my office here and sing to me. But what if you had a hologram, a three-dimensional illuminated version of Frank Sinatra with a perfect rendering of his voice
mm-hmm.
right here in my presence? That would be very much the same thing, wouldn't it? I would experience
yeah.
the look and hear the sounds of Frank Sinatra in that way. I think that's what this... I think. To a large degree, that's what this particular spiritual implement, this Malach, represents. So he responded, "Behold, here I am." You know, when Yahweh invites us to Pesach. Okay, we're given a clue by Abraham here. Should Abraham not have answered this question? Forget about Abraham's answer for a moment. What would be the smartest thing that you could, the most reasonable, appropriate, appreciative thing you could say to Yahweh when he, knowing that he has invited us to attend Pesach, Matzah, Bekorim?
Yes, I'm coming.
Yeah. How about just... So, he responded, Hena Ani. Behold, I'm here. Look. Hey, I'm here. You invited me. I'm here. Right?
Yeah.
So why can't anybody else put this together? Why can't they realize that Kara is the basis of Mikra? It's to be invited, to be called out, and to be welcomed into God's presence. And Abraham was invited into God's presence by God himself, as we have all been. So Abraham responded and answered and said, "Behold, here I am.
That's right.
You called, and I'm here.
I'm here."
Put it together, folks. Yahweh invited us all to attend Pesach. Why doesn't the whole world say, "Behold, here. I'm right here, right now."
Great question.
I'm paying attention. Oh, so something so powerful, and yet it's lost on so many. And he said, he, the Malach, requested and announced, declared. And by the way, I have he here in the chapters, a lowercase he, because it is the Malach. And by the way, you know, there is an uppercase and lowercase in Hebrew, and you know, in English I use the uppercase he when it's God. But you know, this Malach didn't represent the entirety of God, but it was certainly like a hologram of God there. And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand towards the boy, and do not approach him or do anything that infringes on his free will. Indeed, now and henceforth, I know that surely and emphatically you profoundly respect and genuinely revere your God. Consequently, you have not withheld your very special and precious son from me." Now, when I said I think that this Malach is like the hologram of Yahweh, when he ends it by saying, "from me," what do you think the likelihood is that I got that right?
Pretty good.
Pretty much, yeah. Right on.
pretty much resolved right there, because the Malach isn't saying, "Hey, wow, you know, you're all good, because, you know, I was really wanted your son, and you didn't withhold it from me." No, obviously no. God. And Abraham knows he's God. Don't stretch out your hand. Why? Towards him? Because I'm going to stretch out my hand. This isn't about you, Abraham. It's about me. Do not approach him or do anything which infringes upon his free will. I want Yitzchak to be able to choose. It's his life. He needs to choose what's going to happen for his life. As for me and my diminished manifestation, Yosha, he's going to choose as well. And what's interesting, Yosha is going to choose to please Yahweh. He's going to do what Yahweh desires. And so, as it was for Yitzchak, don't ever infringe on his free will. Don't take his life. This makes God pro-choice, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And pro-life. All in the same. All in the same sentence. And al-asha lahu ma'uma means you should absolutely never act to physically defile him or engage to blemish him in any way, nor endeavor to benefit by doing something he does not actually choose or genuinely desire done to him because of the ongoing and unfolding implications regarding him. Call him perfect, Joseph. Free will is so important to God. And God doesn't want us harming anyone else. And the single most important person, I should say, that God doesn't want us to harm is our own children. Don't infringe on their free will by telling them lies. Don't try to get them to go to church and be religious, which is infringing upon their free will. Don't impose your politics on them, your patriotism on them. Don't harm them in any way. Don't infringe on their free will. So by not infringing on his free will, this has nothing to do with not physically taking his life. This is a reference to all fathers regarding their sons. Don't mislead them. Don't infringe on their free will by conveying your politics, your patriotism, your religion, your values. Don't do that. Allow them to choose how they're going to respond to God without poisoning them. Don't infringe. Don't blemish them. Don't defile them.
Tab of the stone later.
Yes, absolutely.
And he says about the children, you know, the fathers do this to their children for generations.
Yep. The second statement, fathers, corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation. Exactly. It's exactly the same message that he's trying to communicate here. Indeed, Now and henceforth, I know. Yada. I recognize and respect. I acknowledge and understand. I have been made aware through observation of the fact. And it has been made known. He didn't say, I believe. I have faith.
I know.
Based
on facts.
I know, yeah. Observation and fact. I know. That's what we ought to say when it comes to God. I know. That's what God says to us. I know. No gray area here. There's no faith. There's no belief. There's no... I would ask you here. Was there an intermediary that explained this to Abraham or that intervened on behalf of Abraham to God the Father?
No.
No.
I always liked his deal.
No. There is no intermediary.
No preacher.
There's no intercessor. Not even a human messenger. No. This is Yahweh communicating to Abraham, just as he's communicating to us, through exactly the same words of the same Torah, teaching us the same thing, and then us responding to what Yahweh has to say, and then Yahweh saying, based upon what you have done, what I have witnessed that you have done, I know. I know. Surely, and profoundly, emphatically, without... truthfully, genuinely, you profoundly respect and genuinely revere your God.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
You're already. I looked it up again and again. And if you really look it up, you find revere, respect, inspired reverence.
Mm-hmm.
Always, and it's always the second, third choice. Oh, where the heck did I get the fear? It's not in the letters. It's not in the words. I mean, that really, they have to make that up. If you're going to have a king, if you're going to have a lord, you got to have your God, and he's going to represent God, and God's got to be like your king. That's so obvious.
Let's just say up to this point here. What mm-hmm. did Yahweh do or say in his discussions and meetings with Abraham that would have instilled fear?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Did he once tell him, obey me or I'm going to kick the crap out of you?
Yeah, no.
No. Did he ever tell him to worship me?
Yeah, he didn't say fall on the ground or I'm going to kill your nephew.
Yeah.
Tell him to stand up, right?
He liked his nephew.
Right. Right. In fact, he even said, listen, your nephew is a scallywag.
Yeah.
And your nephew's family ain't worth saving.
Yeah.
Your nephew's wife is... she's a pillar of salt.
Yeah,
I want to tell you, I know you love him, and because you love him, I'm going to spare him. But, oh my God. I guess he can't say that. Oh, myself. I'm going to do this for you, but oh, myself. Oy vey.
That is a bad choice.
It's a bad choice. I'm going to give you what you asked for, but it's really a bad choice. Those people down there, they are rotten. So, here you've got God throughout this. I mean, when Abraham, who was the smartest to him, said, didn't get anywhere. He said, listen, hey, God, you keep on offering me an inheritance, and what good is the inheritance because I've got no offspring? And he was petitioning at one spot for Ishmael, and God didn't go, well, hey, he's a really cute kid, and, just like I spared a Lot, sure, I'll spell, because it's important to you, I'll spare it. No, he said, no, not in this case. Ain't gonna happen. But even he said, when I want you to send Yishak away, send him away with provisions. He's your son. Send him away with provisions. God didn't do anything in his dealings with Abraham
that would inspire fear or worship or any kind of concern. Matter of fact, when Abraham was asked by Yitzhak, "Hey, Dad, where's the lamb?"
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, "Shut up, kid, or God's going to strike you dead."
And we don't question God.
We don't question God. No, he said, God's going to provide the lamb. That's what he said.
Now, you got to be real comfortable.
Right. So,
yeah.
There was no fear here. There was respect. I know what God's going to do, what he promised to do. He's promised to prepare to provide the lamb. He came to that conclusion because he respected Yahweh. Therefore, to translate in this context, Yare fear, says that you haven't read the context. That you're completely unaware of what has been said and what has happened up to this point. There is no viable option other than revere and respect. Now, I happen to like words like Yare, which can be translated fear or revere, afraid or respect, depending on the context, because
there is a time.
This is the fundamental free will choice. Revere and respect Yahweh. Pay attention to what he says. Act upon what he says. Accept what he says. Trust him to do as he has promised. Or you sure as hell are going to come to fear him because you're going to be judged by him.
Mm-hmm. You work against him, absolutely.
So it's either you choose to respect him or you will come to fear him. It's a perfect word because it shows both sides of what of the human free will expression in this regard. Consequently, you have not withheld your very special and precious son from me. And Yahweh will not withhold his very precious son for us. So that's what the power of this is that Abraham so respected Yahweh that he did not withhold his own son. Yahweh so loves us that did not withhold his son from us. Marvelous story, right to the smallest details. And this was a very special and precious son. Et ben ata et ichad ata. Accordingly, your only, uniquely, exceptional son. It's interesting here that Yahweh has two sons. One's an exceptional son. But Yahweh has two sons, Dod and Yosha. He most certainly calls Dod his son. He says, he is my son, I am his father. That makes Dod Yahweh's son. Yahweh doesn't say, I am his father, he is my son, unless Dod is his son. So he has, that's his son. Now, I don't know if there's a lot of places where Yosha is referred to as the son of God in the Hebrew. There's places that speak of him in that context of a child being born, and the same word, Yichad, being born. But nonetheless, we certainly know that Yosha represents the son of Yahweh.
In name indeed.
Right. And so Yahweh had two, one of whom he withheld from this kind of thing. He died a very old man, a very happy man. Dod. The other, his physical life was shortchanged for this particular purpose. You know, it's the most amazing. I was reading going by one of the local churches here, and it's one of the vans as I was driving up to the Baltimore the other day. And on the side of the van, there was a pastor promoting himself in his church. And it says, Jesus died for you.
Okay.
beyond the fact there's no Jesus. How does this idea of a dead God, a God that man can kill, is just so laughable to me. Anyway, he did not withhold the Passover lamb and the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And that is a marvelous story. Now, it's not over. There is more to it. Go ahead, Kirk.
Well, I was going to ask you, just skipping back a little bit, but on Yahweh, the root of Yahweh, the first two letters, mean to point in a direction. And it's Yahweh's hand reaching down that lifts.
Right.
Uh-huh. And it's pointing at an observable man, a man who's observing,
right.
Rather.
Right.
And if Torah's instruction guide is teaching in direction, it's certainly direction, because he's pointing you in a direction. So once again, it gives a little more credibility to the Yahweh. I know Yahweh can be fear, but it has to be in a very small context, and that's when you're being judged by him. I mean,
right.
He's not going to judge
you. You're being judged by him. You're in trouble. Yeah, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And that's fair. But to come over Yahweh and just keep doing that, it's ridiculous to keep translating that way.
Yeah. It's pretty profound, though, that in Yahweh's name, the hand is reaching out towards the man.
Mm-hmm.
The Yah.
And they're pointing in the right direction towards
the
man.
Yeah,
towards the man. I mean, my gosh. Think about that.
Yeah, is the hand reaching out towards the man, not away from the man.
Right. I mean, if you wanted to hit him or something, I mean, you could slap him with a cough. He would have used the K word.
Yes.
It's just not, it didn't make sense.
But what's being presented.
I did something really odd when I looked up Yod, and I was going through all the different things of that which you have in your writing, in your analytical part there. But I found a word that I had never run across. I'm sure you have, but it's Yahad.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what? And you know what that means? It means to become Yehuda. It's stretching. And it's a yod, a delete.
Yeah.
And so you've got a yod or Yahweh reaching out to lift up a man who's standing up and serving, or a woman,
mm-hmm.
and pointing towards the doorway, to go through the doorway. And that's what we're trying to be as part of this family, just all equal Yehudas. You know, even though I know there's Israel, there's Yehuda, and then there's the rest of us. But we all become his children. Thus, we all become his family, and Yehuda is the one he talks about as his family most. So I just, to me, those are cool things you just run across.
Yeah.
I know they don't have a lot of bearing on what we're saying.
No, but God
has a very rewarding to do this stuff. I'm telling you.
So we only have a couple of more minutes, but this is the really, I think, the crescendo of this story, and we'll return to it a week from today. And it says, then Abraham, the father who raises and lifts up, lifted up his eyes, and he looked, ra'ah, he observed, seeing, inspecting, perceiving, understanding, discovering, considering what was being revealed, and acknowledging the situation regarding the one this was actually about, observed, henna. Henna being used here by as a verb. A ram. Now, A-L, now. A perfect male lamb, the leader of the flock. The framework of the doorway, its doorpost, bam. The upright pillar to support the home. The source of empowerment. The mighty one. After this, a car. Because following these things, was caught, was seized and held, was fastened in the intertwined thicket, the intertwined, intertangled, twisted, and interwoven, circuitous, burdensome thorn bushes, from circular to turn things around. By his horns, Karen, by his brilliant rays of light from a supernatural source, his glowing and shining appearance. And Abraham walked over and accepted the ram. And he offered him as an uplifting sacrifice and placed his son Well, that's the whole crescendo of the story. It's the moral of the story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
For Abraham to understand, for us to understand, we have to look up. We have to lift up our eyes. We have to raise up our eyes. You don't bow your head. Those preachers that would tell you to bow your head, those Muslims that do their prostration prayer, you can't see God if you're looking down. You're looking at Hasatan when you're bowing down. He lifted up his eyes. He wasn't. This is not bowing down, folks. This is not closing your eyes. He lifted up his eyes. And he looked, he observed, and acknowledged the situation regarding the one this was actually about, and observed. Tenna, closely examined, paid attention, standing upright, looking up. There was that ram. Ayil. Now, this is a very common word for lamb, but this is the very special lamb. This is the lamb of Passover. This is the perfect male lamb, the leader of the flock, the framework of the doorway, its doorposts, the upright pillars support the home. After this was caught, was seized, was fastened, just as Yosha was, in the intertwined thicket, Chabak. You know, when I think of the intertwined thicket, most people just think of the crown of thorns. But the crown of thorns, yes, it is a subtle reference to that. But
it's caught up in the Roman aura as well. As
yeah, this twisted.
It's a society of
politics and religion of man, of this circuitous reasoning of man. Man's propensity, particularly Christianity and Islam, to turn things around, to invert them, to use circular reasoning, to twist. So that's what he was caught in by his horns. These were not the ordinary horns. These were brilliant rays of light from a supernatural source. And old Abraham, he wasn't afraid of the lamb either, was he? He walked right to it. I walked right to it. The lamb didn't rebel. He said, no. This lamb will walk willingly to the sacrifice because this is the Lamb of God, the Passover lamb being provided for God to fulfill Passover. And he offered the lamb as the means to ascend Olah. Bar-Rashid 22:13. Precisely what Yahweh would do for us on Pesach. This very same place, exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years later. This is 2,000 Yah. He would do this in 4,000 Yah, and he will return in 6,000 Yah. That is the story that is being told here. How in the world? People disassociate this story with the one and only covenant. Or how they disassociate this story from the one and only path to God, the Mikra, when this story exists to not only affirm both the covenant and the Mikra, but to bring them together so that they're inseparable. Because the second condition of the covenant is to walk to me and become perfect. Well, what did Abraham do? He walked to Yahweh for the purpose of becoming perfect. This is the path that of the Mikra. And that is precisely what is being offered. So this story literally brings the two most important parts of Yahweh's Torah teaching together. The covenant and the Mikra. Bereth and Mikra. And I don't think there's one in a million people that appreciate either of those two connections, much less both of them.
Well, I tell you what, you've done your part. The way you translate these things and write these things, don't ever stop doing the long form.
The truth is in the details, isn't it?
It is, most certainly.
The insights are in the details.
Yeah. And one leads to another, but no to another.
Right. This is a profoundly important story. An inspiring scene that affirms the means to become part of God's family and the path that we must walk to Him. And if you don't understand the words, you're going to miss all of it. You're going to be misdirected. Your life will be sacrificed.
Well, you can easily led somewhere else.
Yeah,
that's my problem. I didn't know.
Yeah, away from God.
What are y'all doing for?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, I just want to say, what are y'all doing for Shabbat this week? You know, celebrating Sunday night?
Yeah, Sunday. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, for Shabbat, I see that what we're doing this evening is as much the result of Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what we do in these programs is teruah. But we teruah because of Shabbat.
Yeah.
You know, Shabbat is the means to enlightenment and enrichment and empowerment that enables us
to
share this message. Yes, the insights that are being conveyed here are a direct result of Shabbat. So without Shabbat, and you know, part of this too, and I hope I haven't gotten too kind of all inclusive in this, but I actually see Shabbat as this continuous event that it is part of our everyday lives. As like as you said, you went to bed the other night just excited about how profound and detailed and accurate and compelling and convicting and reaffirming the consistent this Yah's message is. Well, that I think is an eternal celebration of Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of live every day.
Absolutely.
Sort of live every day as Shabbat.
Yeah.
You know, it's not every day that I get to Teruah to actually share the message with those who are interested in hearing it. But I can Shabbat every day. I can be enriched and enlightened and empowered by God at every moment and every day by studying His testimony and pondering it.
Yeah. He's, to me, he's more and more there. And not that he wasn't before. It's just it's, when you do this, it just is really like, y'all came over and let's chat a while. You do the chatting out for it.
Yeah.
Now I write it down and say, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And, you know, so much of this is Yahweh just speaking very directly, openly to us as a father would to a son. That's what the story we're reading is our Heavenly Father speaking to us as His children. And, you know, considering that He just happens to be the Creator God of the universe, it might be important to listen to Him, but just for a moment, let's pretend that the voice of this message was not the Creator God of the universe. Let's pretend that He wasn't responsible for our lives and our world. Let's mm-hmm. pretend that He could not offer us an eternity in this universe. And the one that He'll create for our enjoyment. Let's just pretend that this is a really unique father sharing an important message with his son. It's a really, really instructive, educational, moral story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still be a great way to go through life.
Yeah, even if it wasn't God, you gain a lot by listening to this story. Now, the very fact that this has eternal consequences makes the story the single most important story you could ever listen to. But the story is entertaining and enlightening and empowering and enriching all in and of itself. And then you just happen to layer this the two other factors of, and the storyteller happens to be God.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequence of listening to the story and accepting it and responding in the same way is eternal life and being adopted into his family. Man,
and yet it's one of a million, one in a million people that do it. How could we be, humanity be so
lacking.
So foolish? Yeah, so lacking, so foolish, so misled, so wrong. And
we'll just go right through it.
I'm gonna listen to a pope or a pastor or a priest or some drivel by Paul, and I'm gonna prefer that over the testimony of the creator of the universe. Why would anybody do that?
Well, I thought you and JB were I couldn't always leave when y'all say you go back to it and you go back to it and you find something new and something new. A couple times I say, well, that's about as exhausted as you could do on that word. Not so.
Yeah, not so.
I don't know, because your perspective is always changing. Your understanding evolves, your knowledge evolves, and then, so you look at it in a whole different light every time.
Yeah.
Correct. No, that's why I like doing these shows on these books, is because, by the first time you go through it, you have so many powerful insights and things you want to share. And then as you go through it again, very seldom will I read anything that I wrote. You know, I do if it's a detailed story, for example, about child sacrifice. Because I did a lot of research, I wanted to be precise in that. But when it comes to just insights from the testimony, I never read what I wrote, because I want those words to inspire all new and additional insights, and they do. And then, you know, a lot of times I'll have somebody say, you know, the story you told there, you ought to go back. Like we had a story the other day about the reason for Chawa being provided to help Adam. Mm-hmm. You know, and I had originally, when I wrote that chapter, I said, well, the reason that Chawa was given to Adam is that without Chawa, Adam really doesn't have a choice. Man is a social being. He would go insane if he chose isolation from Yahweh. So, therefore, he really didn't have a choice, and that's not what Yahweh wanted. Yahweh wanted him to be able to choose to engage with him or not. And so that's why Chawa was offered. And that's true, but I never understood what the word help was about. And then I came to realize it as we were talking the other day, going over one of these passages, that Chawa helps us understand the covenant, the family of God, and the role of mother and father in conceiving and raising children. Chawa is the means that helps us understand that. Now, so I could go back to that chapter, which was one of the chapters and observations, and add that insight, or just say, you know, why? The insight in the chapter is good. It's correct. The fact that there's another insight, well, that's kind of the value of participating in and listening to this program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we went through it, that statement again another time, which we will someday, we'll garner something new from it, and we'll grow again. You know, somebody was offered to give a copy of one of the books to someone. I said, no, the only problem with this is that, you know, there were like 10 books before this one. And it kind of, we're growing and learning, and it presupposes that you know where we've come from. And, you know, you're just not starting out here. But, and that's our story. We began in a place, and we have grown, and we continue to grow. And the more we observe, the more carefully we listen, the more we grow.
Yeah.
And so this gets right back to the idea that you can be religious and pray to God, or you could be wise and listen to
Him. Just shut up and listen.
Yeah.
Shut your mouth and listen.
Right.
You'll learn more that way.
Yeah, you know, and think about this. And somebody would say, well, don't you know that God wants us to talk to Him? Well, think about this. When you take the time to observe what God said, really examine the words like we're doing here, and then really listen to what He is proposing and asking and offering and the like, it's impossible to do that in a sincere and open-minded way and not react to it in a very positive way, to be enthusiastic and excited about it, and just almost glow about it, smile from ear to ear. Don't you think, as Yahweh's son or daughter, that God enjoys that and can perceive that? Do you think that God is so dense that with his children that he made this offer to, that he is educating in this way, that he is incapable of recognizing your genuine enthusiasm and appreciation for what you're learning? You don't think that's good enough?
Yeah. The creator of the universe is saying, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, when we come up with a profound insight, he's right there with us. He full appreciation of it.
Yeah.
Us taking the time to say, hey, God, that was really neat. Thank you very much for sharing that with me. It's almost like you don't give him credit for being able to recognize the appreciation and the enthusiasm that you've already garnered from it. And now you're interrupting the learning process by yabbering at him.
Yeah, okay. That's fair.
My view is, okay, that was great. What's next?
Yeah. Good deal.
That was great. What's next? Yeah. All right, fellas. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, J.B.
Celebrate Shavuot.
Thank you,
and be back with back together again a week from today.
All right.
Happy Shavuot. Happy
Bye,
Yeah.
That's good.
Shavuot. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thanks.